When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to New Books Network. I am Bernardo Batiz Lasso, and today we have Guido Alfani talking about his book, God Among Men, A History of the Rich in the West, published by Princeton University Press in 2023, in which he analyzes how the rich and the super rich throughout Western history accumulated their wealth, behaved or misbehaved, and helped or didn't help their communities in times of crisis. Guido Alfani is professor of economic history at Bocconi University in Milan, Italy. He's also an affiliated scholar at the Stone Center for Socioeconomic Inequality in New York, a research associate at Cage Research Center, the University of Warwick in the UK, a research fellow for the Center for Economic Policy Research, CEPR, in London, England, and a fellow of the World Inequality Database in Paris, France. An economic and social historian and an historical demographer, he publishes extensively on Italy and Europe and beyond, specializing in economic inequality and social mobility, in the history of epidemics and famines, in social alliances, systems, and social networks. Guido, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Bernardo. It's really a pleasure.
To start, you know, could you please tell us briefly how you became an academic and interested in researching the topic of this book?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that I realized pretty early when I was a student in economics. I studied in a program called the Economic and Social Sciences, so I got exposed also to economic history, sociology, and other areas of social sciences beyond economics, pure and simple. But I think that I realized pretty early that I was interested in doing research. And in that specific program, possibly one third of the students ended up with the idea of doing a PhD or something like that. Then I was interested in many things, but one reason why I developed from very early on an interest in inequality is that I remember asking questions in courses such as, you know, economic development and others about inequality, because it was very rarely mentioned. I tended to get answers which I didn't find particularly convincing. This was like in the 1990s, and the point is, back then many economists would say, yeah, no, inequality doesn't matter much if the economy is growing, which I thought was an issue, right? And I also thought, and this is maybe something which also comes from the fact that it was influenced by sociology and other approaches to social sciences, but I also thought, well, in the end, inequality is a relative concept. So even if everybody is experiencing an improvement in absolute terms in their condition, which is a big if, by the way, the fact is, if the difference between the bottom and the top will tend to increase, the bottom is not going to be happy only because they can get an extra hamburger or whatever, right? So I was thinking there is something here which I don't understand. And as I didn't understand that, I immediately wanted to research it, understand it better, which is why from the very beginning I was including in my research interest distribution inequality and so on.
Thank you. And therefore, which authors are the ones that you think that have influenced your thinking the most, and why?
Right. So if we think about inequality and the history of inequality on its own, an author which really inspired me at a certain point was Jan-Martin van Zanden, because he published this fantastic article in 1995, which back then was the only attempt at measuring inequality for a European region in the pre-industrial period. And I always was interested in the pre-industrial stuff, actually. So when I decided to become an economic historian, my instinct was for going to the for going back in time as much as I could. Basically, I started my early career focusing on the period from 1450 to 1650, right? And then I've been expanding that in both directions, so going as far back as the Black Death in the 14th century, and sometimes I reach until today, like in this book, in my analysis. So that is one. And then more generally, I have learned a lot from people like Peter Lindert, who really was very, very generous with me across my career. He was really also providing a lot of very useful advice. He's a really generous and very wise person. And then for inequality studies, from a more technical view, I think I've learned a lot from Branko Milanović, from a range of books. And also I am glad to have had plenty of opportunities to talk with him and discuss things with him. Instead, if we think about, in general, the economic inequality of continental Europe in pre-industrial times, I have been influenced a lot by the older generation of economic historians, people like Fernand Braudel and Carlo Cipolla, and I increasingly find myself going back to these kind of authors because I think that we have been forgetting something, which is normal because, you know, every generation focuses on different things, and then we tend to sideline aspects of economy and society which were crucial to the previous generation, but at some point we also have to try and integrate, right, what different people did in different periods of time.
The study of elites in academia usually sits in the realm of sociology or cultural studies. So how do you recognize or reconcile this with your interest in economic history as the way that you have put it together in this book?
Yeah. So I found it very easy to integrate what sociology has to tell us about the elites, but not only the elites, also about aristocracy, nobility, and in that case, it's mostly the work by Max Weber. Really had some fantastic insights into those topics, which have been researched little, by the way, by subsequent generations of sociologists. They focused on the elite, but there is very little in sociology beyond Weber about things like the nobility, which, of course, you know, for me is important because I also go, you know, back to the Middle Ages when nobles were a key component of the wealthiest people in a society. I've been less interested, so to say, in cultural history, pure and simple, because I have dig deeply into what history in general has produced, for example, in terms of describing and discussing the fortunes of different dynasties or different individuals across time, or providing key concepts. But I think that from my point of view and from the point of view of this book, there is more sociology than cultural history. Although I do address quite directly some issues which have to do with culture. For example, when I discuss the how the rich are perceived in different periods of time. Also in that case, I rely more on other areas of the social sciences, like, for example, history of comic thought or philosophy. I could tell you more about this, but as a part of one of my previous ERC projects, we had worked a lot on how scholars, and these for the medieval period on, it means mostly theologians and then philosophers, basically, discuss the issue of inequality. And from all that material which we have collected, and which remains, unfortunately, mostly unpublished, I was able to fish out the text which actually discussed the role of the rich in society, right? So that's another area, which of course is close to cultural history, but it's not exactly the same thing.
And if we can we make a parenthesis here, and could you tell us or what advice you would give or share with an early career researcher about writing a book and selecting a publisher?
Right. So the problem here is that there is a difference between what I think would be the optimal solution for the intellectual development of an early career and what is reality, right? So for me, the optimal solution would be actually that from your PhD thesis, you start writing, which at one point might become maybe first a couple of articles, but in the end, a book. So something, you know, not really the old way of doing this, but something which doesn't forget about the importance of learning early on how to write a longer scientific text, which is not the same thing as writing an article, you know, for many different reasons. You have to think differently, write differently, the rhetorics are different, you know, the way in which you structure your reasoning is different. In practice, however, this is something that flies in the face of having, you know, to address the very real need of establishing the conditions for getting a job after the PhD, which means that, generally speaking, students today, and I also encourage my students to do exactly the same, actually, tend to write their thesis as collections of articles, which often are only loosely connected, right? So the problem is the following. I mean, if you do that, then you shouldn't abandon the idea of writing a book when you're still a fairly young researcher. Otherwise, it's going to be very difficult to learn to do that properly. And then if you do it, if you decide to write a book as an early researcher, it's better that you, you know, ask around to people who have written books for some tips, for some advice. Because I remember when I was in that position, I got advice which might seem very simple, but it's not trivial. For example, you know, if I can give one bit of advice, you know, to young scholars, don't think that the introduction is where you begin the book. Introduction is where you end the book. So the point is, the introduction is the last part of the book that you write, right? Because writing a book takes so long that what's in the book will not necessarily match exactly what you thought would have been in the book at the very beginning. So, you know, things like this, it's very simple, very practical, but you have to ask. And then selecting a publisher, that's kind of a complicated thing. It depends a lot on the kind of book that the young scholar is writing, because if that is a very well-researched book with substantial information and so forth and so on, the ideal option would be to try and see whether some top international publisher is interested in the book, you know, publishers like Princeton, Cambridge, Oxford, these kind of publishers. And then if they are not interested for whatever reason, and this might also be because in that moment in period for that collection, they prefer to have more established scholars, which sometimes is the case, then you go to other publishers, try to, you know, aim high, and there is all the time for doing this, because the book proposal can be made based on only one part of the book, not the entire book. So while you continue writing, you can start checking, testing the ground, so to say. And of course, that's another point on which asking, you know, seeking counsel and advice from people who have already written book might really help a lot.
That is very insightful. Thank you. So let's go back to the book. And at this point, I would like you to give us a big picture, perhaps a concise overview of what the book is about and where it sits with the overall discussion in the field.
Yes. So what I wanted to write, and what I think I did write actually, was a general history of the rich in the West. Why the West? For two reasons. First, because I don't think I don't think we have a literature in languages which I can read for areas of Asia, for example, on this specific topic at least. And second, because what I argue in the book is that there is something in the Western culture which can be traced back to the Middle Ages and even to antiquity in some degree, which is important and persists across time, and it shapes how we perceive the rich and the kind of role we assign them to perform in society. In a sense, this is also a stepstone to maybe one day having the possibility of writing a global history of the rich, right? Which would be very, very, very interesting to read, but we don't have the conditions for doing that for now. And then I wanted to explore the idea that it's relevant to look at the rich, defining the group of the rich only based on their wealth, not any other characteristic, because most previous attempts at looking at the elites had used the concept of class, which is in some respects entirely fine. But the problem there is that you tend to skip the issue of the composition of different percentiles, quantile distribution across time, right? So I wanted to be very open about the possibility that in different moments and periods, different categories of individuals were more prevalent among these upper quantiles. So that's what I wanted to write, and to do this with a very long run perspective, which is why I systematically covered the period from the 12th century until today, and sometimes I pushed back into classical antiquity when it's relevant and when I can do that.
And what type of archive, what type of data were you able to use to put forward this argument?
Yes. So I could rely on my previous projects, on my ERC projects, for getting information about the wealth share of the rich, again, defining them in different ways. I look at the top quantile, so I try to compare systematically the wealth share of the 1%ers and of the top 5%, right? Because, of course, if you move up, you will observe also a change in the composition of those who are at the top. And interestingly, as the book progressed, I could continuously add new cases, because now more than 10 years of work on this kind of information, we have data about many European regions, sometimes going back to the immediate pre-Black Death period. So it's pretty good. And then I had to connect this material, which comes from my projects and which brings me to circa 1800, with other estimates that have been produced for the modern period. And that also requires some tweaking of the figures, but this is something that I've been doing for quite a bit of time. Then I also did something new based on the same sources. And by the way, all this information, you asked me about the archives, all this information comes from original archival research done by myself or by my team in the European projects. And we also, the team published also this information, or co-published with me, but I was relying mostly on information which had already been published, if you want, plus something which was new. But then I was, and all this data comes from one specific kind of sources, which are fiscal assessment of taxable wealth, that for most cases relates to for most cases, these are property tax records, which include real estate, so lands and buildings, plus capital investment invested in trade, and sometimes all other components of wealth as well. So there is some work to be done to make the information more uniform. But then I also use the same kind of information, as I have information for the entire distribution, to define the rich in a different way, which is a relative way, because the problem when you look at the top wealth shares is that you are saying, okay, the rich are always the 1%, so 1%, or always 5%. But you would also want to allow the prevalence of the rich in society to vary. And to do that, I relied on the same distributions, but I used a new method which is very simple. In fact, it's clearly not rocket science, but you know, it's a simple idea, but possibly it's also a good idea. So I worked in a way which mirrors the definition of relative poverty. So I set a richness line, and I define as rich those are above 10 times the median wealth. And if you do that, you can then explore the percentage of rich in different periods in time. The funny thing is that we can do that with the data we collected for the pre-industrial period, but we can't do that for the modern period because usually we don't have the complete distribution. And I think there will be an interesting opportunity for trying to tweak what is being doing for today and for the 20th century by trying to look at this other perspective. And then to this, I added specifically for the purpose of the book, another branch of research on the sources, which has to do with the composition of the rich. So I had to rely either on those relatively few in general, but there are some, those fiscal records, which also give you information about the occupations of the rich, or at least some other relevant information to me, for example, whether they were nobles or not, plus for the modern period, a variety of rich lists, which have been produced by scholars or published by newspapers or published by Forbes for the most recent years. And then I tried to elaborate the information in a homogeneous way, which was matching the way in which I try to disentangle the main path to affluence across history. And I focus on three, which I think are the main ones, so nobility, entrepreneurship and innovation, and finance, which I disentangle from entrepreneurship and innovation because culturally it is the one which has created the largest consensus, the greatest consensus, basically. I also, look at other paths to wealth, for example, practicing liberal arts, like, being a successful doctor or lawyer. But I argue that these are not as important as the others. So the way in which I re-elaborate the information from rich list matches this. And then, as the book is pretty broad in content, on certain specific topics, I had to look in the literature for data, where I had to spend quite a bit of time in getting some estimates for aspects which, apparently, in Abadia, they were researched systematically. Like, for example, the saving habits of the rich across history. So how large a share of their yearly income they were saving. And I was surprised to discover that there isn't that kind of information around, no research on that, almost no research, neither for the pre-industrial period or for today. And that was even more of a shock to me because it was, well, at least for today, there must be, hundreds of studies and scores of institutions which provide this information, but they don't. So we have, very few studies, some related to the OECD or other institutions, but we are not nearly where I think we should be regarding that. So again, I had to look into specific sources, specific segments of the literature to address specific problems which I encountered in writing the book.
Okay, great. So now you start, or Pareto used the metaphor of a river to illustrate the risks of elites becoming impenetrable. Could you please elaborate in this metaphor and how is it present in your work?
Now, I regret not having mentioned this metaphor in my work, which is a pity because it's a very nice one. I actually forgot about that. I studied Pareto's thought where I was a student, both in, both for its sociological contributions and for its contributions to the history of economic thought. And of course, I know his contributions to the study of inequality, but that I kind of forgot. So it's a pity. But what I write is somehow coherent with the idea that there are phases during which the elite are more open and phases during which they are less open. And the way in which I address this problem is mostly by considering one specific aspect, which is how you have these phases during which becoming wealthy is relatively easy. So if you have a lot of new wealth getting into the elite, right? But then new wealth tends automatically to become old through the process of inheritance. So you have the second generation and the third generations who maybe do not have the same capabilities, the same skills, the same attitudes, and the same interest of those who preceded them, which of course is a problem because the further away you are from the generation of the founders, the more difficult it is to argue that you have merited your wealth as opposed to having simply inherited, which is something that to us today is relevant. In our perception of the wealthy, we tend to believe that it is more legitimate to be wealthy because you made your wealth compared to having simply inherited it. And that's our cultural stance on this point, not necessarily that of our ancestors, by the way. So the other thing is, and here you have Weber, which comes to our help, is that when you have the establishment of wealth dynasties, at a certain point, those dynasties will tend, and we can really observe this repeatedly in history, will tend to become aristocratic, which doesn't mean they necessarily seek a title of formal nobility. An aristocracy doesn't require nobility to exist, but it becomes a group which has some shared tastes, shared behaviors, and which looks upon those who don't come from the same group, were not born into the group, right? So the point is, if this is correct, and again, I think there is plenty of evidence of this, you have a moment when the social and the economic elite at the top, which is becoming aristocratic, you know, being a member of aristocracy for Weber basically only means having some sort of privilege. But having a privilege means that not everybody can have it. Otherwise, you know, a privilege shared too widely is no privilege at all, right? So the point is that aristocracy will actively try to keep the newcomers outside. And we see this, for example, in the United States, when, of course, there is no formal nobility. We see this developing in the course of the Gilded Age in the 19th century. And then by the turn of the 20th century, it was very clear. And then to me, the problem becomes, and I make this hypothesis in the book, though I have to say this is one aspect which should be researched more, but I make the hypothesis that this very process tends to lead, you know, the world opportunity to dry up, right? Brings to an end these phases of relatively easy enrichment, or at least it contributes potentially to bring that to an end, which I would argue is what was happening at the beginning of the 20th century. Then we have the world wars, which make everything confused. And if this is true, if there is this historical regularity, then we might want to look differently at what's happening today, right? So Forbes just published the list of billionaires for last year. And if you look at those who are at the top, they are not, you know, new people. They are not even young people. You have the dominance of guys who made their wealth, maybe in the new sectors of the economy, like, for example, Bill Gates, but, you know, from the 1980s or earlier, in some cases, right? So the point is, these people who establish these very successful multinational companies aren't also establishing the conditions for not allowing us to profit fully as a society from the potential of younger people who maybe, you know, they have their startup, which goes very quickly, and then that gets bought by the likes of Amazon or of Microsoft, and then arguably the innovating potential that they had is somehow disrupted, you know? And then, of course, individually, these people become very rich, but then maybe, you know, they are pretty young and they use their wealth to buy an island and go live happily there forever without doing anything more, which possibly might have favored economic development and then, you know, possibly brought to positive consequences for the broader society. So this is, you know, the problem, I would say, one of the main problems, I would say, with the issue of elites becoming aristocratic and then also relatively closed.
And that is something that, I mean, we could have a very long discussion on this very interesting idea of how, you know, this lack of permeability is, you know, could be explaining a number of moments of political change. But let's leave that for a moment there. And I really like the way that, as you have articulated just now, you've made this view of the rich as wealthy as not being homogeneous or having a homogeneous group or behavior. But you present a much more nuanced discussion of the rich and the wealthy. So what is the difference? On the one hand, what is the difference for you between being rich and being wealthy? And secondly, could you elaborate a little bit more about this nuance in their behavior?
Right. So I don't make an explicit distinction between rich and wealthy. In fact, I claim at some point in the book that I used those words in the same way. So I don't, as a foreigner, I don't perceive a difference. So I found it interesting to use both because it allows for better writing, basically. Otherwise, you would have plenty of repetition of the same word. So what I do is to compare these different definitions, so different quantiles. Like, you know, I don't go beyond the top five, but I then look, you know, I compare that with the top 1% and sometimes the top 0.01% and even smaller percentiles. And then you can observe that there is a change in the composition, right? Which goes in different directions according to the epoch. For example, if you look at the Middle Ages, the more you focus on the top, the higher the prevalence of nobility will be. So you lose all the artisans in the 16th century, in the 15th century, or even in the 17th century. While sometimes people in the guild system do belong to the 5% in that context, right? And so this is kind of a general problem. I also try to be very clear about the fact that the wealthy people, and this includes the super rich, which today sometimes we look at as semi-heroic character, but they make it very clear that these people are human beings with, you know, exactly the same issues and virtues that other human beings have, including, for example, the idea of being the ones who are better suited to decide what to do with their money, right? Only that, you know, if me and you, Bernardo, decide that, we are not maybe causing any, not producing any consequences for society. But if a super rich decides that he or she is the most suited for this, then he might decide that he wants to pay as few taxes as possible and instead maybe doing some giving of charity or whatever, but taking the initiatives. So that's, you know, entirely different. They're still human, and I also think it's human not liking particularly to pay taxes for pretty much the same reason, but still we have to be forced to. So that's the point, right? And also, if you look at politics, there are studies which clearly show that, you know, as all human groups, the political preferences of the rich and the super rich are varied, although there is also some evidence that if you move up, the prevalence of those who have more center-right views increases, right? The more you move to the top. But this is, you know, not kind of deciding the matter, if you want. The point is, really, they are all different one from the other, and they have different intentions, motivations, and whatever. At the same time, it's often possible to observe how from these individual set of preferences, right? Individual defined set of preferences, you have some sort of collective behavior that in general points in a specific direction, which again doesn't mean that I'm not meaning here collective behavior in the sense of any organized behavior or everybody moving in the same direction. I mean more like the emergence of a pattern before, which points in a certain direction. For example, a big issue we have, and I discussed this in the book today, is whether the prevalent position among the super rich and in general those who are rich enough to contribute to political causes is actually pushing the political platforms in directions which are not favorable to, for example, increasing taxation on the super rich, or even favorable to reducing taxation upon them. And that's, of course, a big problem. And again, to have these, you don't need any, secret society of the super rich at all. You only need that the more prevalent position of them is that to have this net result. And there are a number of situations in which you can observe a phenomenon emerging from this very varied set of individual preferences. And a challenge for the book has been to kind of keep together variety, in ideas, in compositions, and so on, and emerging tendencies, right? And I hope, I was actively trying not to be rigid about this, but also I was very actively trying to identify what I call red threads across history. So these very long-run tendencies, which sometimes all of a sudden make us realize that we have facing the same problem that our ancestors in the Middle Ages or in Athens in the classical period were facing.
And moving things a little bit, what did you have to learn more about as you were progressing the research or drafting the content? What sort of areas you thought that you needed to address, even though that you have worked in this area for some time?
Right. So, first of all, during the many years which took me to finish this book, I've been collecting information about possible examples, because in the book I discuss topics systematically, but every now and then I actually do this also systematically, but I introduce more narrative sections which use a specific example of a rich guy or a well dynasty to illustrate and to better explain what I mean. So I have been collecting these cases for a long time, and then I had to select them because they want to write a 2,000 pages book. Mine is much shorter, only 440 pages. So not really brief, but still, not super, super, super long. And then for each of these cases, I had to look in as much detail as I could in the literature which was discussing them. And then for me, the other challenge was to learn more about the modern period, because I'm not a specialist of the modern period. So I had to to study, for example, what was happening in the United States in the Gilded Age from many different angles. And that was something that I previously only knew in a very superficial way. That has been a very funny discovery in some respects. I thought that was really a great period for addressing the kind of concerns I wanted to address with the book. And the same is true, for example, for the position of the rich in finance. That also was another sector of the literature which I knew only marginally before. And I also, and this, this will make you personally happy, I also had to read much more business history than I usually do, because sometimes the studies of individuals of dynasties are, belong entirely to a tradition of business history. The more I moved far from the periods and the topics which were more traditional for me, the more I had to try actively to study well the topic. And then I also did another thing which I would recommend the younger scholar to do. I sought advice from colleagues who were knowledgeable in those topics more than me, and I handed them the draft of parts of the book. And you know, this is why I have this very long list of people to thank in the book. And some of them were really extremely generous and helped me immensely to identify, either to identify additional angles or to better put into the right perspective what I wanted to say. So yes, I mean, with a book so broad, I mean, although all things which relate to inequality, I think I can say I knew very well already. But with a book so broad, you will always get into areas for which you have to be humble and study, right? And that's how we learn, by the way.
So just as you have to learn a number of things, there's also stuff or things that are left out. What would be the interesting nuggets of information or drafts or themes that if you had space, you would have included?
Right. So from when I set out to write the very first words of the book, I had this concern not to write a too long book. That really didn't want to do. In fact, sometimes it was more difficult for me because I was trying to be synthetic. And so, you know, the book, you know, I intended the book to be systematic. So all which I thought was essential is in the book. But for example, of those all those cases which I had collected and they thought they were fantastic cases, well, some of them had to be left out. They might have been, you know, fun to read, interesting to read, whatever, but still that would have maybe diluted too much the main argument and so forth and so on. So there is a lot of material which I had to leave outside. I would have maybe like to say more, I mean, this is maybe with some hindsight, to say more about the expenditure of the rich, right? Which I do. I have a book on the consumption and saving habits of the rich. But then, the kind of evidence which I would have preferred wasn't necessarily readily available in the literature. And on top of that, again, I wanted to be relatively synthetic, but I could have developed that part, specifically the expenditure part, because I focus much more on the saving part, that I could have developed a bit more, and that might have been in general for the greater good. The problem is also when you realize that there are some topics which you could have discuss better in the context of a book such as this, that might also mean that you would have increased repetition, which I was trying to keep at a minimum. So I think I can say that there are very, very few repetitions in this book. Only sometimes I have some of these, at the end of the book, I have these some more topic focused chapters, which also briefly recall something that is previously said. But it's, I think, pretty minimal. But if you think along those lines, there are clearly other aspects, which could have become the object of an entire chapter. Then again, the problem was, do I want to write a 1,000 pages book or a much shorter book? So the book is only 440 pages, pretty dense, I would say. So it's, you know, not short at all, but still not 1,000 pages either. So, but I really wanted to keep this manageable because I think that these very long books are often read from beginning to are very readily read from beginning to end. Right? You know, we could run a survey of how many people have been read from beginning to end, capital in the first century by Thomas Piketty.
I mean, it's also this Richard Langlois book on the corporation, which also quite thick, and you know, not everybody has been able to go through all of it, but some people have. But that's not true. So, but let me make you one next to final question, which is. Most of the book is about white men. And most of the history of the world is about white men. Do you see any reason for this to change permanently in the future, or is there a need to, maybe it could be a project from for a young scholar to look at the, the behavior of wealthy women and open up this focus.
Yeah. So the point is the following. I mean, I have a problem which is connected to my sources about what we can say about women, especially in the pre-industrial period, where they tend to be hidden by the source, which is something I very openly acknowledge at the beginning of the book. And whenever I have the information, I also try and bring women to the fore of the discussion. Because the problem is these fiscal records, they were provided at the household level, and usually you only know the name of the household head, which is a man, except for widows with underage children, who temporarily appear in these sources. So that's the very practical limitation. This being said, there is another aspect, which is that in the long run, wealth has been controlled by white men in the Western context. So the other problem was, let's not give the wrong impression. There are entire sections of the book in which I focus on women. There is one which I am particularly happy with, which is the role played by women in finance, right? And why finance? Because finance, and this might surprise those who don't know about this, but finance for women in the past, when they had some sort of juridical limitations to how they could act in the economy, from that point of view, finance was relatively open to women. So they could act in that economic sphere. Most of them were widows, but not all of them were widows. And we find them in the early modern period. We find them big time in Wall Street in the late 19th century and then after. And also some of the examples I make are a fantastic women like Gracia Nasi, who comes from a Jewish family involved in finance and also in the spice trade in the 16th century, and then she becomes a widow. She has to escape. She wants to avoid being forced to marry some other people. So it's really a fantastic story. So the other problem is this changing today? Well, if you look at the composition of the Western billionaires based on the Forbes database, you could find some reason to hope that things are changing because the prevalence of women in that group has doubled between 2001 and 2021, from above 7 to about 40%. Good, very clear. Still a minority, but growing. Problem is, it's less than half, much less than half, those who have, based on the same source, inherited their wealth, which big time, suggests discrimination against women when wealth is passed on. I would say, I mean, I would hypothesize that this happens mostly in the case of enterprise wealth, right? So you pass on the leadership of the enterprise to a male because you have a cultural bias or whatever, or prejudice or what you want. What can be done? Well, there are areas of research in economic history in which a lot is being done to unearth the role played by women. As it happens, finance is one of that, right? So there are colleagues who have done excellent work in the last few years about women involved in finance. But why did they do that? Well, first and foremost, because they do appear. Otherwise, we have examples. I mean, we have some exceptional cases when we know the involvement of the wives with the head of a company. I mean, one case from the Middle Ages is that of Francesco di Marco Datini. We know that when I mean, this is one of the main European merchants of the 14th century. He was made a orphan by the Black Death, and after that, he sells everything, goes to France, establishes his company, trading between France and Italy. He becomes extremely wealthy. And we have entire personal and business archive, which was rediscovered in his palace in the Tuscan city of Prato at the end of the 19th century. So we know everything because we have all the letters he exchanges with his wife. And so we know very well that whenever this guy was around Europe to visit his companies, his bases in other parts of Europe, she was managing the firm in Italy, right? But the problem is, this is a totally exceptional case, not because she was the only wife doing this, but that's because she's the only wife always for whom we know this, because we have these exceptional sources surviving. So the point is, there is a lot of very, you know, important and very proper work done on those cases and those sources, which allow us to glimpse something which usually is hidden. There will be probably a great opportunity for, you know, exploring this better, looking, for example, into notary deeds. So this is an opportunity for young scholars. Notary deeds are tough, however. These are one of the most complicated historical sources for the pre-industrial period. So it's really, you know, it requires a lot of time doing this. And so maybe one day we'll be able to, for example, write a history of rich women in the West. We probably could do that already, right? But focusing on relatively few cases for which we know a lot. But again, this is a very worthy objective, only we have to be wary of not hiding discrimination behind that, right? So the point is, the prevalence of men in my book matches an act of discrimination, which is also explicitly discussed in the book, right? And I hope this is a good way of doing this. And I hope you are happy with that.
Yes, no, I'm very happy with that. And finally, then, what is it that you're working now or your next big project?
Right. So now I am very busy in getting to publication a long series of long delayed articles related to research done in my ESC projects. One was on economic inequality in pre-industrial times, and the second one was on social mobility in pre-industrial times. Right now I have two articles with various quarters on different parts of southern Italy, for which we could reconstruct inequality from the beginning of the 16th century until 1800. So, you know, this is going along this path of providing information for more European regions. And then at a certain point, I'll be able to take the next step, which is when we'll have all this information available, which does not only involve Italy, but also other parts of Europe, for which I have a lot of unpublished data, like, for example, South France or Catalonia in the Iberian Peninsula. When we have that, the next step will be to see whether it's possible to produce an overview of that, which might be a book. I think one day I would write a book of this kind, but I'm not sure that would be kind of my next book. In a shorter run, I have committed to write a book which also is delayed. It's kind of a much shorter book for the Polity series, What Is? So this is going to be What Is Economic History? Which is, you know, nice answer, nice question. Very complicated answer, of course.
And which we will be very interested in reading, and hopefully we'll have you back here in New Books Network talking about even that how you solve that complicated answer in a relatively short space of time. Guido Albani, thank you very much for being with us today, talking about your book, As God Among Men, A History of the Rich in the West, published by Princeton University Press in 2023. Thank you to our listeners for being there. If you are a subscriber, if you are not a subscriber, please subscribe. If you are a subscriber, please don't forget to leave a message or rank us, as all of those things help us to continue with this
project. This was Bernardo Battitlanzo. Thank you very much for being with us today.